From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on September 26th at Hofstra University. The first presidential debate lasted 95 minutes. It included questions about personal income taxes and emails and where Barack Obama was born and ISIS and whether or not the people running for president were going to accept the results of the election if they didn't like the results of the election. All of that and more, but not a single question on climate change. Then the vice presidential debate, questions on temperament and emails and who said what about women, but not a single question on climate change. Then the second presidential debate, questions about Billy Bush and who said what on that bus and whether foreign cities have fallen or not and who said what about China and Russia and Mexico, but not a single question about climate change. And finally, the third presidential debate, and well, do you get the idea by now? It seems like there could have been at least time for one or two or maybe even five questions on climate change and energy policy over the span of the 6 hours. And if they won't do it, well, we're going to try to do that on Connections today. Now, I don't have the presidential and vice presidential candidates here, but I've got a panel of folks who can help us understand how they view at least the important questions that are out there and the questions about policy going forward. And it's not to pick political sides. It's to at least just understand where things stand in the world today with climate. So our guests are not endorsing a side. They're not endorsing candidates. Let me introduce them now. In studio is Vas Petrenko, a paleoclimatologist with the University of Rochester who has done work in, among other places, Greenland and Antarctica. And it's nice to have Vas back here in studio.
Thanks for having me.
Also here is Karen Berger, who is a lecturer in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. Welcome to you, Karen.
Thank you very much.
And on the line with us is Andrew Light. He's a former senior State Department climate change official who worked on the creation of the historic 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. He's also a professor of philosophy and public policy at George Mason University. Andrew, thank you for taking the time for us.
Thank you, Evan.
Andrew, I'm going to start with you, and let me kind of start with a question about what the question should have been. I guess I'll just start with this question for you, Andrew. Should we be frustrated that climate change was essentially ignored in these debates?
We should be frustrated. I don't think that we should be uniquely frustrated. We should be frustrated because I don't believe that we've ever seen two candidates further apart on the reality of climate change and what to do about it than the two candidates from the two major parties in this election. I don't think we should be uniquely frustrated because I believe that climate change was one of those issues, along with many others, that was fell by the wayside because of more attention on, let's just say, the personality-driven issues that really have swamped the campaigns, especially in the last several months.
Okay. Karen Berger, were you frustrated?
I was frustrated, not necessarily surprised, because I think many people in the public are much more concerned with what's happening tomorrow or next year, next month, than what's going to be happening in what's more of an indefinite future.
I'm going to say I was surprised, Vas Petrenko. I'm going to say I was surprised because, you know, Paris is less than a year ago. There is at least a growing amount of attention in the American media, probably not compared to the world media, and I know that there's a long way to go there. But you had 6 hours over four debates. I'm going to say I was surprised. Were you, Vas?
I was really surprised, and mainly because this is, in my opinion, one of the most pressing issues that is facing humanity as a whole today. As Karen mentioned, perhaps it's not an issue that is immediate on the timescale of days or weeks or years, but an issue that that is kind of cumulative and is progressively getting worse and going to continue getting worse. But nevertheless, it's well understood at this point, and therefore it should have been one of the things that did come up.
There are so many questions that could have been asked, and I would have obviously loved the opportunity to be the man moderating or among a panel of men and women moderating these debates with the candidates. I would have probably loved to dig into energy policy, et cetera. I think at first, just to kind of examine their views, Andrew's right, they're very far apart, and that's not really in doubt. But I think I would have asked them how they feel about the Paris Accord and if it was sufficient in their view, or if it was, as some have said, you know, maybe the first step, but not necessarily even sufficient to slowing down climate change long term, and that we need to go farther, you know, very soon. And so, Andrew Light, I think that would have at least established where they view Paris. I'm not expecting any agreement on the two candidates, but I think that would have been instructive. What would you have liked to ask them, Andrew?
Well, can I just say one thing on that? I think that if we would have had a question as directed and as, I think, well put as that, you would have gotten a very unsatisfying answer. I mean, Donald Trump would have deflected it, as he did. This actually slightly came up in the very first debate, and Clinton defended the Paris Agreement and then said, and Donald Trump thinks that climate change isn't real, that it's a hoax perpetuated by the Chinese.
Right.
Trump did what he did in many of the primary debates, which was completely denied something that it's clearly on the record.
He lied. We know. He had the tweet, right, where
he said that. And then it sort of, at that point, you've got a moderator who doesn't really know the issue, unlike, let's say, you know, some of the moderators were experts in American politics or in foreign policy or something like that. But we didn't have a moderator who's an expert on climate change or energy policy, and so they really didn't have the ammunition to try to push further on that and get a debate. But I would have loved to have seen that. I mean, I would have loved to have seen, even, let's say, we know that Donald Trump is also on record sort of saying that he would renegotiate the Paris Agreement. So I would have loved to have seen a question, having been one of the U.S. diplomats that negotiated the Paris Climate Agreement last December. Exactly how would he do that? How would he force 194 parties back to the table to do this, especially if they'd asked us in the third debate, because shockingly, and this is really impressive, I think, with respect to overall global momentum on this, the Paris Climate Agreement has actually reached the threshold of a sufficient number of parties representing a sufficient percentage of global emissions to enter into force. So it's a reality. Like, the U.S. has already deposited its instrument of ratification. This is a reality. The first meeting of the parties of the Paris Agreement will happen week after next in Morocco. So exactly how would he go about, just kind of forcing all those parties back to the table? There's really not a way he could do that.
Interesting. Okay, that would have been a wonderful question to ask. Karen Berger, what would you have liked to ask the candidates?
I would have liked to ask them something about the Clean Power Plan that Obama proposed that was looking at having states reduce their energy use by 30%, but giving the states the independence to do it on their own, and really look to say, how are you going to do this so that we don't increase electricity costs for consumers and have this be an effective greenhouse gas reduction without having inequities appear?
Okay. Vas Petrenko?
I think the questions that Andrew and Karen would have asked are great. I think it would have been really nice for the voters to see a fact-check discussion of what science says about climate change. And the basic questions that should have been asked, well, first, is the global climate changing? And if so, how? And, and that question was not there. And the facts are that global average surface temperature has warmed by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the last century. Most of the warming has happened in the last 40 years. 2015 was the warmest year on record globally, and 2016 seems on track to exceed that. Extreme heat waves have increased. Most of the excess heat, of course, is being absorbed by the oceans. If you somehow magically manage to concentrate all of this heat into Lake Ontario, it would actually be enough to completely boil off the lake about once per year. Then in terms of ice cover, the extent of mountain glaciers is decreasing almost everywhere in the world. The northern hemisphere snow cover and Arctic sea ice extent are decreasing, and the large Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets are losing mass. Sea level is rising at a rate of about 1/8 of an inch per year, driven by the expansion of warming seawater, melting glaciers and ice sheets, and it has risen by about 2/3 of a foot in the last 100 years. And then, of course, we have the greenhouse gases, most prominently CO2, that has gone up by 44%, and methane that has gone up by about 150% due to human activities over the last 250 years.
Well, listeners, if you want to weigh in on the questions you would have liked to ask the candidates or what you think our panel should ask, and maybe what we'll do is we'll hammer out a framework of questions, and maybe the Presidential Debate Commission will give us time in the next week to get together with them and say, we're sorry we missed these. And here's the slate of questions. 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Voss, when you say there were basic questions on science not asked, it's true, but they've each in their own way in different venues addressed that. I mean, you almost seem to want that question to come up for public shaming, or at least as a kind of disqualification kind of a question, or do you think there's a better function for that kind of a basic science question?
Well, that's a great question. I think that it's important for our leaders to it's important for our leaders to understand science and to acknowledge the scientific facts that are out there, and this extends far beyond climate change. The fact is that Hillary Clinton understands and acknowledges the science of climate change, whereas Donald Trump does not.
Okay. Karen, how do you feel about that? Would that be a fair question to kind of tee up for them on the science?
I agree that that would be a very interesting question. I think some of the reason why it's important to look at the science is the extent to which the public questions this. There was a study by the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, and they claim that only on a national average, only 41% of people think most scientists think global warming is happening. And if we could have this in an environment where the fact-checking was really happening, that would help educate and bring out those differences.
Sure. Let me turn this to Andrew Light in a bit of a different pivot there. My concern in that kind of a question is this. It wasn't just climate change that Donald Trump has spread really, really not only poor information, but potentially dangerous information. He cast doubt on vaccines in this campaign during a presidential debate in the primaries. He linked autism to vaccines despite all the evidence. I mean, really, the list goes on. And if he is standing there with 80 million, 100 million people watching, just telling, and he's got tens of millions of people who will vote for him who really believe that there's some sort of a hoax going on here, that just sort of further cements bad information. And in the meantime, Andrew, you know, you worked on the Paris Climate Agreement. You're trying to create these global frameworks to deal with this problem that some percentage of the population doesn't think is real. Is there a danger to continually spreading that information, or do you think in many ways that kind of that horse is out of the barn for some segment of the population?
Yeah, I agree, Evan. I think the horse is out of the barn. I think that, look, I believe that if Donald Trump had sort of really doubled down and said something about how, you know, kind of went into the science and pulled out some of the, you know, dicier bits of evidence that people will do, the kind of thing that Ted Cruz actually did do quite often on the stump during the primaries, then he'll be speaking to the converted, the people really talking to the echo chamber of people who are already there. I think the good part about that, frankly, is that the evidence is so clear. Vox did a great job of running through some of the top line numbers just a minute ago. And I think from that perspective, what you're really aiming for, the people who, you know, we used to worry about them in reporting this as a he said, she said sort of, literally in this case, debate. But I think this time around, you're gonna really grab and be able to educate more voters who don't have yet enough information about this. And I think that would have been really worth any kind of effect you would have on shoring up the really dismissive people that are identified in those Yale, and I should say also George Mason University polls that are done collaboratively, have been done for the last 9 years, which sort of indicate there's this sort of a dismissive end of the political spectrum, which you're never going to be able to get. And I think that's, we're going to have to move forward on climate change, knowing that those people are kind of insulated in the same way that there are people who are still against fluoridation in the water and many other things that we're not going to get them to budge on.
I think I would have asked Donald Trump a question about someone from his own party. I think I would have told the story of Bob Inglis, who was on this program not that long ago, former Republican congressman who has admitted that his view on climate change was driven entirely by the fact that Al Gore did a documentary about it. And he said, I cannot be on the side of Al Gore on anything. And if Al Gore's for it, I'm against it. That was it. And it became a strategy to try to defeat the idea. And it was his own children who asked him, please check this out. He goes to Antarctica. He comes back. He says, okay, it's real. I admit I was wrong. And his party casts him out as this apostate. He gets defeated by a Tea Party challenger, Trey Gowdy, in the next primary. He loses big, mostly because he came out and said climate change was real. But now Bob Inglis has said, look, I'm still a conservative, I'm still a Republican, but I'm going to devote my work to saying we can do market-based solutions for this. We are an innovative people. He kind of points to what Bob Inglis, a Republican former congressman, and Adam Frank from the University of Rochester have something in common when they both say, in 1890, we didn't have gas stations on every corner, and 30 years later we did. We can do amazing things when we decide to do it with the infrastructure. And I think I would have asked Donald Trump if he believes that the power of innovation can address this. I mean, Andrew, is there any sort of utility to that approach, or do you find that sort of fruitless?
Well, listen, I think that the last bit, what you said there, that really, like, let's talk about innovation. Let's talk about what we can do. Let's talk about whether or not we want to continue the renaissance, or even to put it stronger, the clean energy revolution that we're having in this country right now, which is astounding. I mean, we've seen drops in prices. Land-based wind, the total cost reduction since 2008 has gone down 41%. Utility scale photovoltaic solar power has gone down 64%. LED bulbs have gone down 94% since 2008. I mean, this is we're just seeing such a huge transformation of the energy economy. We've got more people employed now in solar power than in and then in coal, and we are cleaning up the environment while we're doing it. I mean, it's not just carbon pollution we're eliminating; it's regular pollution we're getting rid of. And so the question is: the question would have been, do you think that we should continue this astounding transition that we're doing now with the American energy sector, or should we just try to go back to old business as usual? Should we double down on subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, some of which have been in place since World War One? I mean, I think that would have been a great way to put it. If you put up someone like Bob Inglis, who is fantastic, I think you would have gotten a sort of a dismissive shrug off on that. I mean, think about 2008 when Senators Obama and Senator McCain ran for office there, where they were the two major party candidates. Climate change actually wasn't talked a lot in the debates either, because both of them agreed on just about everything. They both thought climate change was real. They both thought it was caused by humans. They both thought that we should enact a price on carbon through a national cap and trade policy to deal with it. So in a certain sense, I think that, you know, we know what Trump would have done in the face of Republicans who have really turned a corner on this, or have gone back, I would say, to the position of their party primarily in 2008. But I think that the harder question that he would really have more trouble with is the one that you ended with on what can we do on innovation? Are we on the side of innovation, or are we against it?
Well, I want to get to some of your phone calls. I want to remind our listeners here, we've got a wonderful panel this hour. You're hearing Andrew Light, a former senior State Department climate change official who worked on the creation of the historic 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. He's also a professor of philosophy and public policy at George Mason University. Karen Berger is a lecturer in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. And Vas Petrenko is a paleoclimatologist with the University of Rochester, who is not right now in Greenland, but there have been years this time of year where we wouldn't see you here. When's the last trip that you took to a big chunk of ice, Voss?
So that was right about a year ago. That was to Antarctica.
Anything planned coming up here?
Nothing definite, but I am working on a plan trying to get a new project going on Antarctica in about a year.
Okay. So if you've got questions about some of the work Voss has done and what he's seen, I mean, I just read a long New Yorker article about Greenland, and I have all kinds of ignorant questions. I could probably sidetrack and derail on. I'll try not to do too much sidetracking. But this is a good chance for us to get our heads around a lot of different angles here. It's 844-295-TALK. We're about to do something really historic on this program. I've hosted for almost 3 years, and there's a regular caller who's just not buying it on climate change. But because of the quality of this panel, the high esteem that the world holds them in, John in Rochester is going to humbly say, thank you for educating me. And he's on the line now. Go ahead, John.
Well, thank you for educating me. But I have to say that
you're not convinced.
No, I'm not convinced. And I thought it was refreshing that they didn't talk about climate change that much in the debate. There are a lot of people like me out here that think that climate change is happening, but it's not attributed to man. It's attributed to the nature. The sun naturally emitted methane from the earth, etc. And the fact that the fossil fuel industry has been subsidized, well, the solar industry and wind energy has been also subsidized to, I think, a greater extent. I look at this as being to a certain extent, not a fraud, but a movement that started by degrowthers and even Marxists that want to see the industrial society diminish, especially.
Why, John? Why are we degrowthing? Why?
You've said this so many times.
Why do the degrowthers have this evil idea of putting human beings out of work?
Well, I'll give you a good example. Naomi Klein, who's been a Marxist all her life. she was quote, and I read the specific quote. She was very happy to see this climate change, man-made climate change hysteria start to peak, because she stated that this will help defeat capitalism and start the degrowth movement of the industry.
But, John, wait.
Bring the United States down.
Hold on, John, because what you're saying about Naomi Klein, who you invoke in every opportunity, Voss Petrenko, Voss, have you ever met Naomi Klein?
Unfortunately, I have no idea who she is.
Okay, there you go. So he is not an acolyte of Naomi Klein, John. And I understand you think there are people who are putting themselves in profitable positions. Voss Petrenko is a paleoclimatologist who's been to the corners of this planet that you and I have never gone. And I just want to know why you think sort of he's in league with the anti-capitalists.
Well, I'm not saying he necessarily is. I don't know the gentleman.
He's not.
Okay. There's been... The facts are this. Mars and even Jupiter, I read recently, the temperatures are increasing on both of those planets. A lot of it has to do with, I think, methane in those on those planets, and also the sun. The fact is, 12,000-15,000 years ago, there was a mile of glacier above my head where I sit right now. That went away without man being contributing to it.
Yeah, I know.
So there's a hysteria, and a lot of it's driven by a political. And unfortunately, the brainwashing of the left-wing media, which is primarily left-wing, has brainwashed the public, and it's gotten this far, unfortunately.
All right, so, John, before I turn it over to Andrew Light, who is probably not thrilled with me for even taking this call, but I'm trying here. John, did you listen to Bob Inglis, who is like you? He's a small government guy. He's a conservative.
He's a deplorable?
What?
Hillary Clinton called people like me deplorables.
Oh, okay.
Did you listen
to Bob Inglis?
Yes, I did.
And
in fact, I talked to him, you recall.
Okay, right.
And I wasn't convinced.
You were not convinced.
No, I was not convinced.
Okay. Andrew Light, you in your work, you're right. You point to people. It's not just Donald Trump. There are tens of millions who just aren't buying this. And eventually I start banging my head against the wall, Andrew, because I like Johnny. He's a nice guy, but we're just not seeing eye to eye on facts. I like facts. I'm a big fan of facts. And some people just...
Well, I just gave you a lot of facts.
No, you didn't, John.
Without man being a part
of
it. Temperatures on Mars and Jupiter have increased without man being part of it. Those are facts.
They're not facts. I'll put you back on hold. And I'm not trying to dominate the conversation. They are not facts. And Andrew Light, help me understand why I've failed in getting through to some folks who are nice people, but I can't really understand why on the factual side it's not happening.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation out there, and there are a lot of resources put into making sure that there is misinformation out there. And it's not just climate change. I mean, unfortunately, we live in a world now where people are prepared to read everything believe everything that they read on the internet. And we don't need to go into the details on that. Look, I sincerely wish John was right. You know, for the sake of my small children, who are 5 and 7, I certainly wish that this was just all a Marxist conspiracy and I'd wasted the last 20 years of my life working on it, because the future is dire unless we get moving. And we are now starting to do a lot on climate change domestically, internationally, but it's not enough yet. Voss and Karen can go into more detail than I will on the science of this. But, I mean, the preponderance, the overwhelming majority of the evidence is there. The 1 degree Celsius of warming that we've already experienced, which we're already experiencing many severe climate impacts from, is caused by humans. That is the smoking gun. Yes, there are other things out there that we can measure that are affecting the Earth, but this is the smoking gun, which is uniquely causing that increase in temperature, and we know where that direction is heading. And we are, now again, this is, I think, the hottest 16 years on record have occurred in the last 17 or 18 years. This year is most assuredly going to be the hottest year on record again. And the direction of travel needs to be towards solving this. when it comes to this being some kind of conspiracy to take over the economy, let me just tell you that in my community, the people who are really working on these issues every single day, who are buckling down, rolling up their sleeves, and trying to develop policies that respond to climate change and reduce emissions and encourage the acceleration of the clean energy revolution that we have today, which is growing jobs and growing the economy, the facts that we celebrated were, in fact, that for the last 2 years, we have seen globally an increase in economic growth and a decrease in emissions from the electricity sector. Now, that is the key to solving this problem. No one is going to get reelected in almost any government on this planet by saying they're in favor of degrowthing or slowing down growth or decreasing jobs. You've got to figure out a way in which you can grow the economy without it being necessarily tied to greenhouse gas pollution as a byproduct from producing energy. We've already done that in the United States, and now the world is turning that corner. We hope that trend continues, and that is going to be our way out of this into a future, which I think at that point then people are going to see that their whole lives just simply are benefiting from that transition, whether or not they think this problem is real or not. At that point, the debate will be entirely academic in a very weird part of the academy, frankly, about whether or not this is a conspiracy.
I'm late for our only break, and when we get back, we'll get to some of your other phone calls in very different spirits, and I think very thoughtful questions out there about climate, energy, and more, as we talk about what the debate commission didn't talk about. In the four presidential debates, three presidential debates, and one vice presidential debate, there were essentially zero questions on climate change. Really amazing. And we're doing our best to try to fill that gap with this conversation with a distinguished panel this hour, including Andrew Light, a former senior State Department climate change official. He helped with the creation of the historic 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. And Karen Berger's here, a lecturer in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. Vas Petrenko, a paleoclimatologist with the University of Rochester. When we come back, we'll be joined by Tom Drennan, who's a professor of economics and environmental studies at Hobart and William Smith Colleges as well. And your phone calls straight ahead. And let me tell you a little bit about what's coming up Wednesday on Connections, a special edition of Second Opinion Live. We're going to be talking about Down syndrome. One in every 691 infants in the United States is born with Down syndrome, making it the most common genetic condition. What happens when kids with Down syndrome move from childhood to adulthood? We'll talk to a mother and son and a pediatrician about how parents can help young people transition to adult life. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Joe on Twitter writes, the previous caller is really instructive. He's motivating his reasoning with, quote, facts that accord with his political affinity. And Joseph goes on to say, the challenge is to depoliticize this topic, how to disentangle identity from what is known by science. We are working on it. Thank you for that, Joseph. I know Vas, just before I go back to your phone calls, Vas just wanted to jump in on some of the ostensible substance we heard from John. Go ahead, Vas.
Yes. Well, I also just wanted to make it really clear that science is not political. Science should never be political because science is based on facts. It's based on observations that we make and logical deductions that we make from those observations. But I just wanted to jump in and make sure that the record is set straight after John's comments. So first, if we address the question of are we responsible for the observed global warming, the answer is very clearly yes. It's basic physics that has been understood for over a century that greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane will cause surface warming if their concentrations in the atmosphere go up. Computer models of global climate simply cannot reproduce the observed recent warming without human emissions of these greenhouse gases. Studies of Earth's past climate, which is what I do in my research, also confirm this. Periods that had high greenhouse gases in the atmosphere were periods of relative warmth and relatively high sea levels, whereas periods with relatively lower greenhouse gas concentrations were periods that were relatively colder and periods that had a lot more ice. And there is a very strong scientific consensus. About 97% of scientists actively working on climate agree that we are the main cause of the recent warming. As far as the solar variations that John mentioned, so as I said earlier, most of the warming that we've seen has come over the last 40 years. We have a really good record of past solar variations since about the late 1970s, and this is from satellites. looking directly at the sun, and there is no trend. So there are very small variations. There's an 11-year cycle in how active the sun is, but there's no long-term trend to explain the changes. As far as methane is emitted naturally, but most of the methane in the atmosphere today is from us. And one of the reasons we know this is from I-SCORE work, the type of work that I do. We're able to go back as far back as 800,000 years and measure methane concentrations. And what we see today in the atmosphere in terms of the amount of methane is about 2.5 times higher than it's ever been in the last 800,000 years. With regard to Mars, my understanding is that the what has been described as warming on Mars is basically a compilation of two satellite photos that were taken of one of the Martian ice caps. So these are two snapshots, essentially, at different times during different seasons, and the Martian ice caps grow and shrink with seasons. So it's not an indication of long-term warming.
Thank you, Voss. I think I will thank you on John's behalf for that information that helps clear up some of the record. I want to welcome in another guest as well here. Tom Drennan is with us in our WEOS studios in Geneva. He is a professor of economics and environmental studies at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Tom, thanks for coming into the program as well.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, I want to mention two things coming up on Thursday. First of all, there's a new solar farm at Hobart and William Smith. Is that right?
Yes. A 2.5 megawatt solar farm, about 8,000 solar panels. We're building two of them. This is our first, and it just recently came online. We're going to dedicate it on Thursday morning.
All right. There's a ribbon-cutting ceremony and an open house Thursday, 10:30 in the morning at the solar farm. That's on Route 14 in the town of Geneva. Is that right?
Yep. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And so that's going on. And Andrew Light, who's been on the line with us, is coming to Rochester for a talk on Thursday as well. That is, I want to make sure I've got all the details here. Karen, do you have that for me? I have it. Who's responsible for this? Andrew, do you have that? Go ahead, Karen.
The University of Rochester Humanities Center.
Okay, very good. I'm sorry, Andrew. Go ahead.
At 5 p.m., I believe, on Thursday.
Yes. Hawkins Carlson's room of the Rush Reese Library, free and open to the public. And Andrew's going to be presenting on the pragmatic achievement of the Paris Climate Agreement. So 5 p.m., Thursday, the Hawkins Carlson's room of the Rush Reese Library, and that's free. And so that's a great opportunity to hear a lot more about Paris and what we ought to be knowing about that. So two significant events coming on Thursday. What I want to do is get back to your phone calls to help drive the hour for our panel here. And let me go ahead, because a question on solar comes from Michelle in Rochester. So go ahead, Michelle.
Hi. Thank you so much for your panel. I'm just so excited. I feel guilty because I can't afford solar or geothermal, even with the incentive. And I have to run the air conditioner because I have a health problem. What can I do? What other things can I do besides little things around the house and trying to cut down driving to help with this climate change? Also, I have a very good friend who's in Massachusetts with a science teacher. She's conservative, and she doesn't believe in climate change, and she doesn't teach it to the students. And I wonder if that's illegal.
Okay, Michelle, I'm going to jump in only because the connection's a little muffled, but I think I got the gist of on the two prongs. On the first side, she mentioned that she can't afford solar or geothermal, and the question is sort of around the house, what can be done regarding energy and efficiency there. And I don't know, Tom Drennan, or if someone wants to kind of start in with what you would say to that.
I would like to jump in on that.
Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
It's true that not everyone can afford solar. New York State, though, has awesome incentives right now for solar. That previous caller was right. We are subsidizing it, so because that's a goal we've set, that we want more renewable power in New York State. So if you want to put solar in, the incentives are great. Now is the time to do it. If you still can't afford it, then, you know, honestly, your number one source of carbon emissions is likely to be your personal transport. And so that's the other area to try to focus, is making your travel as efficient as possible.
Okay. And the second part of her question was on her hearing about a science teacher who is not willing to teach climate change, doesn't believe that it's real. Should that be allowed? Anybody want to jump in on that? It's come up. I mean, we've talked about sort of teaching climate science in middle school and high school and the importance of teaching it well. So, Andrew Light, I guess I'll start with you on that. You know, as someone who wants the world to understand it better, are we doing a pretty good job of understanding how teachers are teaching it and sort of making sure we're kind of keeping an eye on that?
I think we're just getting there, and I don't know what the approach of New York State is, you know, on this particular issue in the curriculum. There are some states that are moving forward. They're doing the same kind of process they do for creating sort of curriculum standards in the sciences, you know, at different grade levels, and are moving in that direction. I think that it's really actually doing quite well from studies that I've seen on this. I think that one of the most interesting things is, again, going back to those really amazing longitudinal studies that Yale and George Mason have done there, we're seeing a big generational gap. I mean, for people under 30, Republicans, Democrats, independents, you know, doesn't matter how they identify themselves, they see climate change as much more like a public health issue. It's nonpartisan. It's something they expect the government to step in because this is the kind of problem that is so big. It is, you know, formally what we would call a collective action problem, where everyone's doing something in their own interest, but it's actually undermining all of our interests together when you add it all up together. These folks think that this is the proper role for government to step in and do something on that, and I think that a lot of that comes from improvements in the curricular system. So I think that the overall national signs are pretty good. I don't know state by state where we are on some of those particular questions.
Karen?
One thing that is happening in New York State is working with the Next Generation Science Standards, and some of the key principles of that include things like systems thinking, which is inherently important to understanding climate change. So I think a lot of that is getting incorporated into the way they're approaching science locally.
Okay, let me get back to your phone calls. Paul and Irondequoit next up. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I enjoy a lot of these, what I would say, modern energy products, and I'm really quite happy with them. But to me, the term clean energy is really a misnomer. Anything we make has to be done with energy, and we have pollutants. Now, here's what it kind of boils down to me. In the past, we've seen incidents like Love Canal and other really high pollution type places. And the SVTC.org site can bring you up to speed on what's going out in the San Fernando Valley. But I don't know what they're doing with the residuals of the products they're using, like lithium batteries, solar panels, and all that other devices that we use, the modern devices. I don't think there's anything in place to make them return to the environment cleanly. Although I do like the products currently, and I'd appreciate your comment. Thank you.
Paul, thank you very much for that. Karen, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think you make a good point that nothing is truly clean energy, and it's really a question of the trade-offs that we make when we're looking at different energy sources. So if you live in a place where there's no water, then you want to choose energy resources that are going to use less water and be less dependent on that. For example, you don't want to have nuclear in Texas because that's going to become unsustainable. So as we look for more resilient systems, that's really the goal of addressing climate change. I think the point you bring up about the waste stream is important, that people really look at life cycle of our energy systems when they're trying to make a choice about what to invest in.
Okay. Andrew Light, what do you think?
I think I agree with what Karen said on that. We have to look at the life cycle. I got to tell you, I look forward to the day when we are hard-pressed to distinguish between our different renewable energy options based on which ones include fewer embedded emissions from the fossil fuel sector. I mean, that's going to be the kind of problem that we want to have. The U.S. has already made a commitment that by 2050 we should achieve an 80% reduction in our emissions. The White House now has a process to go through and sort of try to come up with a pathway of how it would be feasible to reduce our emissions 80% by 2050. I think full realization of our global climate targets, which are really to stabilize at an increase in temperature caused by humans at 2 degrees Celsius or lower, really is going to include moving to full decarbonization for some of the major economies, both in developed and developing countries. And that's where I think that it's going to be a great day when we are actually having those harder debates about what's better in the renewable energy sector based on those underlying emissions that might still be there.
And Andrew, this is a point in the discussion where I can envision a question that should have been asked in the presidential debates, or at least I think so, which is that we talk about what is scalable. Often you hear the George Wills and many others say, look, there's nothing that is scalable that can replace carbon. And then they decry the subsidies as if oil and gas is not subsidized. And so what would you say, Andrew, to this question on scalability and viability, what kind of time frames we're looking at?
Well, we're gonna know a lot more. I think that the White House report that's coming out, I think just in a few weeks, is going to tell us quite a lot, at least in the case of the U.S., about what's scalable and viable. The numbers that I gave earlier on these really substantial decreases in wind, distributed solar, utility-scale solar, battery, LED bulbs, all that comes from a recent Department of Energy paper that was just released. I think that there are plenty of very, very good plans now. We know a lot more about what it would take to, especially in the electricity sector, move to full decarbonization. And I think one of the hurdles that we still have to get there is really affordable utility-scale batteries. So, you know, we often go back to this idea that renewables, especially wind and solar and hydro, are all fine and good, but you still need baseload power sources, especially when you're talking about wind and solar, that can run when the wind's not blowing and the sun is not shining. And that's always going to mean that we're going to need some kind of fossils somewhere in there. And if we can come up with utility-scale batteries, not the things in your car, but really big versions of that that can run to utility scale, then we will be able to overcome that final hurdle, and we'll be able to get there. The harder, I think, issue is always going to be transportation, but I think that we're making great strides on that, and that was the first actual rule that was rolled out by the Obama administration in creating the Clean Power Plan that Karen mentioned earlier. And I think that as we see an integration of energy markets at a continental level, which was just discussed at a summit with the leaders of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico last June in Ottawa, you'll see, again, as we sort of really approach these economies of scale, which will drive down the price of these solutions, then it's really just a question of how fast we're going to make that transition rather than whether we can make the transition.
All right, I've got a lot of comments to work through on the phones and on Twitter and email as well before the rest of the hour. So let's just try to keep it moving as crisply as we can. Lewis in Rochester. Go ahead, Lewis.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
I have been confronted by a few people lately who have said, we have been covered by glaciers, the glaciers have receded, therefore climate change is a natural process. One cannot argue with that because it is fact that there have been glaciers. I think the disconnect with public understanding and also private school, public and private school education of climate change, the disconnect comes from how it's stated that it's man-made. I've heard that phrase rolled out a few times. Man-made is not causing climate change. It takes place by itself. I'm sorry about the incomplete sentences. Climate change takes place by itself. I think it's what your people are saying is that it's human intervention that's causing it to change at a rate that's never been seen before.
It's exacerbating.
And to levels that have never been seen before.
Sure.
And I think if that were presented to the public more succinctly and more clearly, we wouldn't be having a lot of these conversations that we're having.
All right, Lewis, thank you for that. Karen, what do you think here? Should we change it to from man-made climate change to man-exacerbated climate change? What do you think?
I think language is challenging, and I think we need to acknowledge that, yes, climate has always changed, but we're changing it, I guess, as you say, exacerbating it at a pace that's never been seen before.
And Voss, you've seen it yourself in the work that you've done on the ice. I mean, it's happening. Man is exacerbating it. Do you think he makes a point when it comes to the way people get confused? Because they can understand that climate's always changed and always sort of cycled, so man-made some might have a stumbling block with. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the caller makes an excellent point. You know, in the classes that I teach, particularly when I teach about the history of the Earth's climate, I spend most of my time talking about natural climate change because, yes, the Earth has gone through quite a lot of natural climate changes in the past. But the caller is correct again that the rates of change that we're experiencing today are unprecedented for the entire duration of the Earth history, as far as we can tell from the records that we have of Earth's past climate. So yeah, so I think it's very important to make those distinctions. But it is also important to point out that while the causes of climate change in the past were certainly natural, the warming that the globe overall is experiencing today really is man-made, and there's really no other way around it.
Okay, here's a question from Michael via email. And Michael just wants to know, well, one second, says, Evan, everything I've read about Paris says that they got the best deal that they could, but I'm concerned that it wasn't good enough and wasn't extreme enough, to use the term. Is this true, and what would the political candidates have said? Michael, I don't know what the political candidates, well, I can assume Donald Trump would say it was too extreme to begin with. I don't know what Hillary Clinton would say. I do think that's an interesting question for Hillary Clinton, or for Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. But let me ask Andrew Light to weigh in on that. Michael wants to know if our concern is that Paris was the best we could get, but not strong enough. Andrew?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm going to be talking a lot more on that on the University of Rochester campus at 5 o'clock on Thursday. But the top line that I would just give you for now is that we were clearly headed towards more than 3 degrees Celsius increase in temperature. Remember, we want to try to hold it at 2. We've already gone to 1. If you add up all of the commitments that came into Paris, the countries that made commitments to reduce their emissions at the Paris Climate Conference covered about more than 98% of global emissions. So it's not a 98% reduction. It's just that those countries represented 98% of global emissions. That's the biggest buy-in we've ever had for any of the climate treaties we've created since 1992, and this is really the third of the major ones we've created. If you add up all those commitments, and everyone were able to achieve those, and some will do better, and some will do worse, but if you were at them all now, and you go out to the range of those commitments to 2025 or 2030, then Carbon Tracker, which is a very good independent assessor of these kinds of processes, says that we would stabilize at somewhere in the 2.4 degree to 2.7 degrees Celsius range. Now, that is better than any of us involved in this process since 1992 thought we could ever get out of a climate agreement like this. The good part about the Paris Agreement is that it's not a one-shot deal. So countries came in with these pledges to either 2025 or 2030, and there's a mechanism to ratchet those up. So every country is going to have to put in a new pledge in 2025 with pressure, a lot of pressure to do more than what they did before, and there will also be an international process to inform them of all of the cheaper ways in which they could increase the pace and ambition of their emission cuts over time. So I think Paris was way better than we thought we would ever get, and I think it's definitely moving in the right direction. Should we do more? Absolutely. Should we do more faster? We should. And the good thing is Paris is not the end of it. So just in the last 3 weeks, we've also seen two other major international agreements achieved, one to reduce emissions in the aviation sector, creating a new market-based mechanism to do that. And aviation is the fastest-growing source of CO2 emissions. And the other was a landmark global agreement to get rid of hydrofluorocarbons using the Montreal Protocol, a one-shot deal that will avoid up to half a degree of warming by the end of the century. Again, that's major. If we're at 1 degree of an increase Celsius now, we're trying to go no more than 2. Avoiding that half a degree is going to be major by eliminating hydrofluorocarbons, which are mostly used in refrigerants and air conditioners, and that is one of the most potent greenhouse gases, thousands of times more potent than carbon dioxide. And all of that is really momentum from Paris. So there's what we achieved in Paris, and then there's what Paris created, the appetite for more, and we're already seeing global leaders unstick negotiations that we've been involved in for 8 to 10 years that we haven't been able to do, but now we've got them because Paris has created that momentum.
All right, consider that your preview, 5 p.m. Thursday. Andrew's going to be here in Rochester at the Rush Reese Library, Hawkins Carlson Room there for his presentation, free and open to the public. Real quick, Carrie in Macedon. Go ahead, about 20 seconds. Go ahead, Carrie. Sorry, we don't. Do we have Carrie? Go ahead, Carrie. I don't have Carrie, and I'm going to try, against my better judgment, Megan in Rochester. 20 seconds. Go ahead, Megan.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Evan.
Sure.
This has been a great panel. This has been great. Everyone's really educated, which I think is our biggest hurdle here in Rochester, is education. A woman called in earlier about affordable solar. We have community solar in Rochester, which I think is really important, net metering and remote net metering, where two things I don't think you guys touched on today, and community solar allows everyone to go solar. It's very affordable. I have it. Wondering if you guys...
Where would you send people to... And Megan, where would you send people to learn more on that?
GoSolarRochester.com.
GoSolarRochester.com. Tom Drennan, any quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, many communities are doing that, and other communities could jump on board and do that as well, and I could help people get that info.
Okay, so listeners, if you want to learn more, there's a website, or you can always kind of write in, and we'll kick you Tom Drennan's way. He's kind enough to handle any inquiries. He's a professor of economics and environmental studies at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And before we go, one more quick reminder on what they're doing on Thursday morning: a ribbon cutting ceremony and an open house Thursday morning at 10:30 at the Solar Farm. That's on Route 14 in the town of Geneva. It's free and open to the public. Their goal: to achieve climate neutrality by 2025 at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. So congratulations on that, Tom, and thank you for popping into the studio at WEOS and joining the conversation.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Andrew Light, who has worked on the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, is coming to Rochester on Thursday. We will see you here. Wish we had more time, but thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thank you, Evan.
Karen Berger, lecturer in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester, thanks to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Vas Petrenko, always nice to see you on the warm side of the planet.
Always a pleasure.
Very good to see Vas, a paleoclimatologist with the University of Rochester. Overwhelmed with comments on these kind of subjects. And so I hope you know that even if the presidential debates don't cover climate change, we're going to keep doing that on this program and do our best to continue the conversation. With Rob Braden Engineering, Megan Mack Producing, I'm Evan Dawson, and we will talk with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.